of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Topley reporting from Washington, D.C. Well, those of you who heard the broadcast last week may recall I was trying to talk up the idea of, instead of marching on Washington only, to march into the heart of evil, the actual command center where these problems begin, i.e. Wall Street, the headquarters of the finance oligarchs. And in particular, I was talking about the need for a march on Goldman Sachs to claw back some of the TARP money, the bailout money that Goldman Sachs has looted and pillaged out of the federal budget and the Treasury, and in particular to make that march on the basis of a 1% Tobin tax on Wall Street's speculative turnover. Make Wall Street pay for the depression they've created and which they've imposed on the rest of us. And lo and behold, thanks to a listener who sent me a tip-off on this, there is a march on Goldman Sachs. It's on Friday, the 25th of September. Now, we're taping the program here on Thursday, the 24th of September. But on Friday, the 25th of September at 5 p.m. at the end of the business day, there's a march on Goldman Sachs to protest the shutdown and various anti-labor, anti-worker measures being carried out at the Stella Doro Bakery up in the Bronx. This is a matter of the Bakery Confectioners, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers International Union Local 50. They have been on strike at the Stella Doro plant in the Bronx since August 13th, apparently. The company wants to shut down that factory unless the workers are willing to take wage cuts of 25%, increased payments for health insurance, no holidays, vacations, or sick pay, eliminate extra pay for working Saturdays, and essentially abandon a whole series of other rights that the workers had won over the years. So this is a march. I want to warn people, it looks like anarchists will be there one way or another. Who knows what's going to show up. But I think also there's a lot of pro-labor forces. There are probably some socialist sects left over in the New York City area that are going to show up for this. This looks like being a very interesting thing. Please go to actindependent.org, and there you will find a very good intervention leaflet. This is a classic strike support operation. There's an irony of history at work here. People may remember the old Baltimore Strike Support Coalition at the Schmitz Bakery Workers back in 1971. Once again, it's the bakery workers, it's the bakery confectioners workers, Local 50 this time, that are involved in this in the strike there at Stella Doro. But remember, broaden the appeal by going with a Tobin tax, a 1% Tobin tax. Relevance to Goldman Sachs is that Brinwood Partners, the private equity firm of hedge fund hyenas and asset strippers, have gotten control of this Stella Doro plant bakery in the Bronx, and they're the ones who want to downsize the place, institute, speed up, cut wages, and all the rest of it. So they're basically acting as a front for Goldman Sachs. So here you have it. Goldman Sachs takes tens of billions of dollars from the Treasury, and their private equity leveraged buyout operation, Brinwood Partners, comes forward and tries to gouge and destroy the wages and working conditions of the workers at the Stella Doro plant in the Bronx. Remember, what is needed is not just cheerleading. It's not just passive support. It goes beyond that. You've got to get out there and broaden the programmatic basis of the strike. When you have a striking union like this, you've got to add programmatic elements from the outside, whether or not the workers immediately understand what you're doing, and whether or not they think it's a good idea. You've basically got to find ways to make the program broader than just the Stella Doro factory in the Bronx, although that's going to be a part of it, absolutely. And you've got to try to bring in other social forces, other unions, unemployed workers, any kind of other people that may increase the power of these agitations. And, of course, Goldman Sachs is a good goal, a good target for such a protest. And a lot of ferment about this in the New York City labor press. We can assume that all sorts of counter gangs, the entire group of socialist sects and other relics of the 60s and 70s will be around. Fine, let them do something good. And they will have their own take on it. But the take that I recommend is the Act Independent line. Go to the Act Independent website. You will find a very useful intervention leaflet there that says, support the Stella Doro workers, no layoffs, no increases in the cost of health insurance and the rest of it, but impose a 1% Tobin tax on Goldman Sachs. In other words, don't just protest Goldman Sachs, make them pay. Claw back some of that TARP, right? They got a good $10 to $12 billion, top dollar on their derivatives with the AIG London Hedge Fund. Isn't that amazing? All those Goldman Sachs guys, Cash Carry and the rest of them running the TARP, the bailout. Goldman got that money. There's no way to get it back except through a Tobin tax. A company like Goldman Sachs probably pays zero to minimal corporate income tax. The corporate income tax has gone out of style. So that's another reason why we want a Tobin tax to hit these speculators in the La Banza where it really hurts. So again, the cavorting and the gesticulating of anarchists gets you nowhere. The rather more radical measure is make Goldman Sachs cough up cash. They do high frequency trading. Wonderful. 1%. They do flash trading. Beautiful. 1% on that too. You want to do some program trading? Great. 1% on all the transactions. And you see quite quickly, this begins to take the life out of the booze for Lloyd Blankfein and his merry men at Goldman Sachs. This is a purely parasitic organization. As Taibbi says, it is this vampire squid attached to the face of humanity, sticking its blood funnel at anything that seems to be alive and moving. So the march on Goldman Sachs. Now, that's not going to be the definitive march on Goldman Sachs, but notice also, well-scheduled 5 p.m., rally in Wall Street at 5 p.m. when the brokers get out, and then take it to City Hall and see what Mayor Bloomberg has to do with this. Again, though, watch out for anarchists. The reason I think this is worth mentioning and supporting is because if enough people show up who are not anarchists, sometimes the anarchists can be pushed out of the scene. They can be pushed to the edges, and they're going to do whatever they're going to do, but that may not be enough to ruin and shut down the entire event. So strike support to be sure, but again, beware of those anarchist provocateurs that like to wreck these things. And that's the same story for these events in Pittsburgh. We did an intervention with Act Independent to some of the organizers of the G20 protest in Pittsburgh going on the 24th, 25th of September. For your information, we're taping this program on Thursday, the 24th of September, so I don't know exactly what's going on at the Pittsburgh G20. But there were signs that the usual suspects, the usual anarchists, were going to be doing their thing, and that they had no program. They had no means of making the finance oligarchs pay. Well, we do. And it's a 1% Tobin tax on all of their financial speculation. Back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
World Crisis Radio. So once again, go to actindependent.org on the internet and get this intervention leaflet. Support the Stella Doro bakery workers demonstration against Goldman Sachs on September 25th and ongoing. Call for a 1% Tobin tax on the Wall Street derivatives monsters. That's the Act Independent intervention leaflet. And generally, go to actindependent.org and also check at tarpley.net to find intervention papers, because we put them out. We give you a program so that you can get some content into the agitation. Substance, program, content. That's what is lacking. Lots of militancy out there, but it's got to have goals, and they've got to be intelligible. Now, this is the first anniversary of the crisis. You'll remember it was on a Friday, September 12th, that we had this nefarious meeting at the New York Fed with Paulson, with Geithner, with Blankfein of Goldman Sachs, with Diamond of J.P. Morgan, Lewis of Bank of America, Mack of Morgan Stanley, Thane of Merrill Lynch, the heads of Bank of New York Mellon with their $25 trillion of assets under management, the largest custodial bank, and the back office, indeed, of the TARP, the people from Wells Fargo and so forth. At that point, there was still Wachovia, but they were about to be gobbled up. And naturally, this then went through the weekend. And you'll remember that on that fateful Sunday, September 14th, it was Barclays Bank that played the treacherous role of pretending to be a buyer for Lehman Brothers and focusing the attention of the meeting on them, and then using the deus ex machina of British regulators. British regulators, this is a joke, contradiction in terms, oxymoron. The regulatory regime of Britain is tenuous to the point of being non-existent. The regulator came in and said, sorry, can't buy it. And at that point, there was no time left to improvise a sale of Lehman Brothers. So Lehman went bankrupt in the night of Sunday, September 14th. On the morning of Monday, September 15th, the Fed went wild with essentially plunge protection team operations. The Fed began flooding the system with liquidity. Everybody could get a 0% loan. The Fed would not accept stocks as collateral for the first time in a long time. Lehman stock lost 94% on that Monday, September 15th. The thing that I would point to, and that was on that Monday, September 15th, the Dow was down 505 points, which at that point was 0.75%. By Wednesday, September 17th, there was a panic run on AIG in Singapore, and we got into this area of hedge fund fratricide that as soon as some company, some financial company turned out to be on the troubled list, the hedge funds would circle short the stock and drive it into bankruptcy. The hedge fund parasites were killing their hosts by going short, and even hedge funds won against the other. And by Thursday, you had AIG essentially gone, and so forth. Now, the thing that I would point to, though, the really big anniversary, a few days down the line now, closer to where we are in the month of September, let's focus on Monday, September 29th. This was the day where the bailout, the $700 billion for the Wall Street bandits and parasites, the hedge fund hyenas and asset strippers and so forth, the bailout reached the House of Representatives. And this was a spectacle. If you've seen this, you've seen something important about the United States, that the House of Representatives voted no to that bailout by a vote of 228 to 205. The bailout was defeated on the first vote in the House. And accompanying that, the Dow took a dive of 777 points. This was, I think, an important moment. Now, at that point, the forces, the legions of greed, organized themselves. Paulson of Goldman Sachs took a leading role. He called stupid McCain and said to McCain, "Oh, Senator, those Republicans in the House are voting against our bailout. You've got to suspend your campaign, come back to Washington, D.C., and begin to arm twist those House Republicans in particular so that they vote for the bailout, by now called the TARP, Troubled Assets Relief Program." This, by the way, remember at the beginning was supposed to be to buy derivatives, to go out and buy up derivatives. The big problem, of course, is $700 billion is a lot of money, but there were already 1 quadrillion derivatives, give or take a few hundred million, in the U.S. banking and hedge fund and related systems. So what do you do to shore up a bubble of 1 quadrillion of derivatives if you're working with $700 billion? Then at that point, Paulson reversed his field in a breathtaking and indeed illegal move. He wanted to inject money into the banks, including Goldman Sachs, which at that point was on its way to becoming a bank holding company, another real joke. The Fed, of course, pumping cash into the system as fast as they possibly could, right? They were buying every federal bond, right, every treasury security they could get their hands on. So more and more money sloshed out into the system. They were using the discount window. They were using the open market operations and so forth. And, of course, then there was this the role of McCain, which we've said, but then the role of Obama, which was to strong-arm, in particular, the Black Caucus in the House and other left-wing or self-styled progressive Democrats in the House who had voted against the bailout. And this was where Obama essentially organized the majority. He did his part, just like stupid McCain. Of course, the stupidity of McCain was that he was going to lose in the process, and Obama was going to win. Obama was instrumental in doing his own strong-arming, delivering the Black Caucus votes, delivering a lot of left-wing Democratic votes for this odious bailout of Wall Street. And the crisis then evolved from there. That's the bailout, September 29th, Monday, September 29th, 2008. The bailout defeated 228 to 205, but then it passed on the second reading. Back soon.
This is the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Let me remind everybody of three pieces of indispensable reading. One is Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide to the Greatest Financial Crisis in Human History. You can find a way to order that at tarpley.net. Same goes for Obama the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate. Order that through tarpley.net. And indeed, Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography. It is simply impossible to understand the unfolding events of the world in 2009, 2010 without those three indispensable books. So please get them and support this kind of work. Again, tarpley.net will direct you to the relevant pages of Amazon or Progressive Press, where you can buy these things. So September 29th, Monday, September 29th, 2008, the House voted 228 to 205 to reject the bailout, and Wall Street crashed by 777 points. I think that's the worst day Wall Street has ever had, even up to now. The the TAF was coming into existence, the Troubled Asset Facility at the Fed, $285 billion to buy that. Sorry, term auction facility was going on at the Fed. What then happened was that other forces came in. They began telling these people in the House, you know, guys, this bailout seems to be for Wall Street. They get the money, but it's really a bailout of Main Street, because only if we bail out these zombie banks will they provide the necessary commercial bank credit for business operations in the towns and small cities where a lot of you guys come from, in rural states and outlying states and non-money center cities. And this, of course, is an absurd argument. If you want to have credit, what you do is apply the law, and that means you, Sheila Bair, at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, apply the law. If they're bankrupt, if they have 10, 12, 13, 14% of non-performing assets, they're bankrupt. Seize them, Chapter 7 liquidation, and in the process, the derivatives get shredded. But Paulson had to say, wait a minute, the derivatives are the lifeblood of our system, and of course, they're all inextricably entwined. We don't have time to unwind them. We have these toxic assets, toxic paper. We have newfangled instruments, exotic instruments, all meaning derivatives, as we've stressed over the intervening year and well before. So that is how the people in the House were then convinced to change their vote a few days later and institute this monstrosity of the TARP. We also had on October 9th minus 679 on the Dow. There were lots and lots of aftershocks. And this indeed was the beginning, it has been the beginning, of a world economic depression, which is still going on. In the middle of this, let's highlight the role of Great Britain, of Gordon Brown. He is in some ways the architect of the current form of the world derivatives bubble and indeed of the practice of bailouts. You'll remember that this crisis began in the summer, in August of 2007, with the bankruptcy of Countrywide Bank in California. Panic runs on Countrywide. By October, it was something much bigger. Northern Rock, a bank operating in Great Britain, also in Ireland. That blew up, and at that point, Gordon Brown was the guy who launched this idea that governments would bail out these banks rather than simply applying the bankruptcy laws, winding them up, and wiping out their derivatives. And in the middle of this, the Bank of England, with Mervyn King and Alistair Darling at the Exchequer, deserve special attention. What were they doing? At a time in the fall of 2007, when the U.S. and the and even the Europeans were, the European Central Bank, were lowering interest rates, the Bank of England insisted on keeping a rather higher level of interest rate. What were they doing? Well, this is the traditional beggar my neighbor policy of the City of London. And it means that the British pound looked at the dollar and the euro and said, only one of us can survive this crisis, and we will do our damnedest to make sure that the dollar and the euro go down and the British pound will survive and London will reassert definitively its role as the capital of world finance. So that's the beggar my neighbor. Now, that had a special angle vis-a-vis the small country of Iceland, which we'll get to in the second hour. So this is the situation of a year ago. Now, in the meantime, what has been done? Well, apart from bailouts and from all of these facilities at the Fed and making the FDIC into a hedge fund under Sheila Bair with the PPIP program, it's essentially $24 trillion for the banks in the form of bailouts. The useful components of the stimulus, and they were there, $300 billion. So under Obama, which is simply the continuation of the Bush-Paulson policy under Obama-Geithner-Bernanke, it's the bankers are beating the people by a score of 88-0 to 1. A monstrous situation. Nothing has been done to derivatives. Rather, the approach of the Obama administration has been to stimulate the restarting of derivatives formation. In other words, they want derivatives to metastasize more than they've been. If you look at Obama's approach to mortgages, what is the approach? He wants to restart the securitization of mortgages in the form of mortgage-backed securities and asset-backed securities. That's where the money is going. The money goes to Chase Mortgages. The money goes to the colleagues of Angelo Mozzillo, the gangster from Countrywide Bank. They got the money, and the rate of foreclosures of little people being thrown out of their homes is increasing. So $24 trillion for the banks, special payments for mortgage lenders, PPIP for hedge fund operators, special privileges as always for Goldman Sachs, and indeed for J.P. Morgan Chase, which is actually the higher level in this combination. They do a little bit less dirty work and get a little bit less bad press, but that is indeed the center of the New York money center operation. This is what's going on. So there have been no reforms, even now, 8-9 months into Obama and the Democratic majority. Nothing has been done about derivatives. Nothing has been done to stop foreclosures. Nothing has been done about any of this. The zombie banks rule. There's this pathetic charade of some kind of a consumer protection agency so that you'll be told what the risks are when you buy a derivative or you hock your house with a derivative. This is all a bad joke. And this is now the world ruling class that comes together at the United Nations General Assembly and congratulates each other that they have escaped the gaping jaws of a world economic depression. In my notes for this period about a year ago, let's see if I can find it. It's in the week of the collapse of Lehman. Let's see if we can find it. The abyss gapes. That was Thursday, the 18th of September, 2008. This was the Putnam money market busting the buck, going below a dollar. This meant that the money market funds were all in trouble, meaning that the this is the day also when the report was that $500 billion had gone out of the dollar in the morning and that the dollar was going to collapse by the end of the day, and the idea of the TARP emerged. We'll be back in a minute.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Crisis Radio, Webster Duffy here in Washington, D.C. The U.N. General Assembly is going on, and good news for humankind, the global warming monstrosity of Copenhagen, scheduled for December 2009, is in big, big trouble. This, of course, was the attempt to strangle worldwide economic development with a carbon tax, obligatory binding carbon limits that would essentially undermine national sovereignty everywhere under the cover story of this lunatic theory that carbon dioxide and related carbon emissions are somehow changing the weather. Clearly, this debate goes on, but the idea that it is a result of the sunspot cycle and solar activity is gaining ground, so much so that one of the leading honchos in this international political panel that the UN has cobbled together has said that we've now reached a plateau. He's obviously attempting to do a kind of limited hangout or a line of defense, saying the warming tendency has now slowed down and we've reached a plateau and we're going to stay at the plateau for 10 years. Now, of course, that is an attempt to mask the fact that in reality it looks like global cooling has set in. Get your 2009 Old Farmer's Almanac and you'll read a halfway competent and rather interesting story of how sunspot activity and solar activity in general is the main thing going on with this. Now, Ban Ki-moon, the crackpot UN General Secretary, has called a meeting of heads of state an emergency global warming carbon footprint summit for New York, featuring Barkey, featuring Obama. And the attempt was there to launch a new round of hysterical global warming rhetoric, but the conference is in trouble. Let's look, for example, at the speech by Chinese President Hu Jintao to the General Assembly in New York this week. He says, yes, we in China are willing to do all sorts of things for global warming and on, but there will be no binding carbon limits. And we know that there was this interesting convergence between China and India, found a common front, saying that they reject the attempt to strangle their economies and to throttle their economic development under the cover of this reactionary myth of global warming, a legend agreeable to rich elitists, to parasites, and to other very comfortable rentiers, but obviously not good for the poor people of the third world, people who get by farming maybe one-third of an acre in India and who have to use treadles, right, treadmill-operated pumps to get some water up to have a vegetable garden and eke out a miserable existence based on this. The proposition is clear. The global warming carbon limits mean that world economic development will stop. There will never be development of the third world. And the genocide will go on. It's 30 to 40,000 die every day from this. And it's increasing. 1 billion people, with a B, are on the verge of starvation. They're hungry and could fall into starvation at any time. The Waxman-Markey monstrosity here in the United States, if this were to pass, the export prices of U.S. corn, important for Latin America, U.S. grain, important for the entire world, would double at least. And, of course, when Goldman Sachs gets a hold of the carbon offset market, they will then more than double the export price of that food, meaning that hundreds of millions of people in sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, and other poor areas will pitch into starvation and death. It is an ultra-Hitlerian genocidal project. Must be stopped. Now, Waxman-Markey, this cap-and-trade, cap-and-tax monstrosity, is bogged down. But there will now be an attempt by the global warming fanatics to push aside everything and say, we've got to go on to Copenhagen. Gordon Brown, in his speech to the UN General Assembly, said that the next 6 months will be decisive for the entire future of humanity. He said, we congratulate ourselves that we got through the past 12 months. Yeah, you, Gordon Brown, with your bailouts and with your attacks on small countries like Iceland. Now he says the next 6 months will be even more decisive, because if we don't have a global warming treaty in place by 2010, it's essentially the end of the world. It's all over. And they trot out various island dependencies of the British Empire to say, we don't want to go under the water. I don't think that the evidence on that is at all conclusive. So we also then had Obama's speech to the UN General Assembly. Obama is presiding over a meeting of the UN Security Council where he will preach the doctrine of nuclear disarmament. Now, this takes us right back to Carter. Carter was, of course, hysterically anti-nuclear, fanatically anti-nuclear. Three Mile Island happening on his watch through the connivance of green fanatics helped a lot. But with Carter, you could see how the rhetoric of disarmament could be used as a powerful political weapon. That's what Obama is trying to do. That is also what Gordon Brown is joining in on. Gordon Brown says the United Kingdom has 4 Trident missile-firing submarines. We are prepared to go from 4 Trident missile-firing submarines to only 3. And, of course, the idea here is to put the strong arm on Iran, on North Korea, but also on all sorts of other countries. Interesting in Gordon Brown's speech is that he says the onus of proving that you're not producing nuclear weapons is now transferred to the developing countries themselves. In other words, the rich elitist Gordon Brown, the architect of the world derivatives bubble, presiding over the City of London and the heritage of imperialism over centuries, says, we are putting you in court. You have got to be guilty until proven innocent. And in effect, it's the code Napoleon, guilty until proven innocent, by Gordon Brown, vis-a-vis countries like Iran and others. And, of course, there are lots of others that this can be used on. Gordon Brown says, we'll be happy to help you to get peaceful nuclear energy. Gordon Brown even cited Eisenhower and the Atoms for Peace program. He said, we will create a worldwide uranium bank, and you will be invited to use it. Now, of course, you just have to ask somebody in Iceland, for example, what? How can you trust the British? Certainly, if you ever got into a crisis, for example, if you owed the City of London some money, wouldn't they then find a way to ban you from exercising your drawing rights on the British Uranium Bank? It's just this idea, undermining sovereignty. The only way to push ahead is to have your own guaranteed energy, your own guaranteed production, not dependent on the will of other countries. That is an important component of sovereignty. So nuclear disarmament is one of the cards that Obama is playing. Now, for those who still don't get it, the idea that Obama has called off the Polish missile crisis is exactly what I talked about for the past 18 months. Under Obama, the U.S. takes a step backward from the brink of confrontation with all sorts of other countries. The U.S. is supposedly not going to be involved. Rather, and I went through this in some length, the idea is to play other countries one against the other. Get rid of the enemy states by playing one of them against the other. Example, Georgia. Now, in this case, the cloak is so threadbare that it's clear that the hand of the U.S. is behind it. But remember, Georgia joined by Ukraine, by Poland, by Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, you get an echelon of petty states that can be played against Russia, at least according to the thinking of Brzezinski. That's the goal. So it's not surprising that they want to remove the direct U.S.-Russian confrontation, because the goal now is to use Russia as a cat's paw against Iran. Back in a minute.